This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So what we decided to do was put out Christmas trees in these rows on the beach so that as the wind blows and as waves kind of wash up and wash up against the trees, sand's deposited. And we've been able to rebuild about 130 feet of dune at the state park using that technique.
This week on Sea Change Radio, a conversation about the vast and varied coastline of the great state of Maine with Peter Slavinsky, a marine geologist with the Maine Geological Survey. We learn about living coastlines, efforts to protect Maine's coast from rising seas and more frequent storms, and get a bit of a geography lesson at the same time. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Peter Slavinsky. He is a marine geologist at the Maine Geological Survey. Peter, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
So you've been in Maine for a quarter of a century almost. What has changed in your estimation in terms of the coast and how scientists are trying to get ahead of this inexorable shift in Maine's very large and multifaceted coastline?
Well, that's a great question. I think a couple of things that we're seeing over, especially over the last 10 years or so, is kind of a marked increase in the impacts from coastal storm events, but also the impacts of your nuisance flooding. So the amount of flooding that occurs both spatially and temporally, so the frequency and duration, and the extent of flooding that occurs just from regular high tides. So we're seeing a lot of things that are exacerbated by sea level rise. So we have a relatively high rate of sea level rise over the last 10 to 20 years as you compare it to the long-term record over, say, the last 100 years. It's about 3 to 4 times as high as that long-term record. And that's consistent with what's happening along the rest of, say, the east and southeast coast of the United States. In fact, as you go into the southeast coast, that rate is even higher. And as a result of that, and when you combine that with, say, the impact of storm events, the water level can actually drive higher up against the landscape. And when it does that, it actually erodes the shoreline more. So we're certainly seeing more erosive shoreline events, especially, I'd say, over the last 10 to 15 years. And as a result, we're seeing a lot of impacts to different kinds of habitats, whether it's open coastal sand dune systems and beaches, or whether it's fringe coastal wetlands, or if it's coastal bluffs. We're seeing a lot more erosion of these features. And as a result, humans, of course, we don't like erosion. We don't realize that erosion is a natural process that is meant to occur, that many, many, many other habitats depend on the sediment from erosion for sustaining themselves in the face of sea level rise, in the face of coastal storms and the changes that we're seeing. So there's a lot of, desire to protect property. And again, this is not unique to Maine. This is happening anywhere you have a coastline that's eroding. There's a desire to protect property based on, say, the property lines that we've defined, which nature doesn't really understand or really care for. So there's this conflict of, we love the coast, we've placed a lot of infrastructure along the coast, whether it's houses, whether it's condos, whether it's hotels, whether it's roads, and now we're seeing a lot of impacts to that infrastructure because it's been placed in a very dynamic environment.
From a geographic standpoint, Maine's coastline is really pretty remarkable. I don't remember the stat, but I remember that it's a lot bigger than it looks on a map.
It's a pretty staggering stat, actually. It ranges anywhere from about 3,500 miles to close to 5,000 miles, depending on how you measure that coastline. So we have a lot, you know, our southern coast is probably similar to a lot of the California coastline in terms of the fact it's open beach areas and maybe some pocket beaches and things like that. But as you get into our mid and down east coastlines, it becomes very peninsular. We have a very, very peninsular area where, you know, you're talking about just to get from, you know, you're standing on one point and you look to your left and there's another point a mile away from you. But to get there, you've got to drive about 20 to 25 miles because you have to go all the way up the peninsula and then all the way down the peninsula to get there. So when you add all that up, it's anywhere between 3,500 and about 5,000 miles of coastline, which is a pretty staggering number with a huge range of geological types, which is interesting from my standpoint, because that's what I get to study. I mean, everything from sandy beaches to, you know, rocky cliff-bound coasts, which everybody thinks of when they think of Maine, that's about 50% of our coastline. And about 48% is made up of erodible coast or erodible bluff. And then about only about 2% is like dunes and beaches. So, but the dunes and beaches and rocky coast are what most people think of when they think of the Maine coastline.
So, Peter, you mentioned how you study these coastal events, but maybe compare and contrast your work through the lens of events versus more gradual climate change and how you and your colleagues are working to enact policies and preventative measures to ensure that Maine's coast remains the jewel that it is.
You know, in Maine, there's a wide variety of different coastal types. And, you know, our tide range ranges from about 9 feet along the southern coastline, southwestern coastline, I guess you could say, to as you go down east, which is the northeastern stretch of the coastline, it's upwards of about 20 feet.
Compare that to like South Carolina or something, if you will.
It's probably about a foot and a half to 2 foot range to maybe 3 feet in South Carolina. So, you know, we have these big tidal swings of anywhere from, you know, 9 to upwards of 20 feet. And what that does is it actually creates a little bit more of a natural resilience for our coastline, because if we have a large storm that's coming, for instance, up the coastline, for that storm to have a significant impact on the coastal habitats, like, you know, dunes, bluffs, things like that, we have to have that storm and the storm surge and the largest waves associated with the storm kind of marrying up with the high, closer to the high tides to have a big impact. You know, if that storm hits at low tide, it's basically not even going to be reaching what the tide potentially reaches at high tide. So we have a little bit of that natural resilience, I call it, built into our shoreline. But when we do have conditions marry up to create, you know, that perfect storm of conditions where you've got a high tide, an astronomically high tide, where you've got a storm surge, and then you've got large waves acting on the shoreline, like we did in December of 2023, and then in January of 2024, we had three really, really large storm events. One that set new records up and down the Maine coastline in terms of water levels. But those are kind of like a 1-2-3 punch. So you've got like a natural dune, let's say, along the shoreline. You know, it's a mounded dune, something like this. Well, that first storm took out, let's say, 10 feet of that dune. That second storm took out another 10 feet. All you're left with is this little hump. Then that third storm comes and wallops things, and there's much less dune to protect the shoreline. And we had, you know, erosion of anywhere from, you know, an average, statewide average, about 25 feet to over 100 feet of dune loss in some areas due to this 1-2-3 punch of storms. So, you know, in the short term, we're seeing, I can't say statistically that we're seeing more of these, what we call southeaster storm events. So the traditional storms we see along the Maine coastline are what we call nor'easters, or where the winds blow out of the northeast. But what we're seeing more of, it seems like, at least anecdotally, are these southeaster storm events. And our coastline's been kind of conditioned over a long period of time and shaped in response to these northeastern storm events, and seeing an increase in southeasters, especially southeasters with very, very intense winds and large waves, are hitting areas of the coastline that haven't really been hit that much before. So a lot of our development is at risk from these southeasters, and a lot of our natural features are at risk from erosion due to these southeaster storms. We can say that the amount of precipitation and the amount of wind associated with these events is increasing, but we can't say that the frequency of these events is increasing yet. We just don't have enough data to support that. From a climate change standpoint, how all this fits in is along the main coastline, there's only about a 1 foot difference between like your king tides or your highest tide levels and what we call a 10-year storm. So that's the storm that has a 10% chance of occurring in any given year. There's only about a 1 foot difference in the water levels of those. And subsequently, there's only a 1 foot difference between roughly our 10-year event and our 100-year event. So as sea levels rising and driving up water levels to be higher, the intensity of these events and the recurrence interval of these events decreases, but the intensity increases because our starting point for where the water is when these storms are hitting is potentially higher. And that's happening, you know, that's happening along all the coastlines that are seeing sea level rise. Sea level is exacerbating the impacts of these different storm events.
Days to Christmas. It's getting kind of late, but I love to just sit around and just procrastinate. I don't worry and I don't hurry for anything, no, 'cause you know me, I do all my shopping on Christmas Eve. Some like to shop early in the year.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Peter Slavinsky. He's a marine geologist at the Maine Geological Survey. So, Peter, you were talking about these short-term versus long-term mitigation tools that you have. If you can lay out for our listeners what's most effective in terms of mitigating coastal erosion.
Sure. So it kind of depends on the habitat that we're talking about. So Maine has a long history of working with kind of more of a nature-based solution, or what we call a living shoreline approach, along our coastal sand dune and beach systems. Back after a huge storm we had in 1978, when we saw humongous impacts from, so prior to night, let me just set the stage here for you. So there's two storms in 1978. There was a January storm in 1978, which was a very, very strong storm. It was a southeaster. And then in February of 1978, we had the storm of record prior to January 2024, which was a northeaster. And both of these storms impacted our coastline dramatically. And they caused tens of millions of dollars of damage, which would be in the hundreds of millions of dollars of damage throughout New England, these storms. And those storm events were kind of like where the tide turned, I guess you could say, along the main coastline in terms of how we managed our coastline. Prior to then, there was kind of unchecked development. There was a lot of seawalls that were being placed along beaches and dunes in southern Maine. That was a very, very highly developed section of the shoreline. And then after that, Maine passed what we called Chapter 355, or the Coastal Sand Dune Rules in our Natural Resources Protection Act in the early 80s. And that was as a direct result of what we observed from the 78 storms, which was this unchecked damage that occurred along the shoreline. And the fact that seawalls actually exacerbated the erosion of the beach and didn't even protect the upland property in many cases. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of seawalls that failed. And then because they failed, the upland property was at risk. And then because of seawalls, there was a lot of end effect erosion in areas that didn't have seawalls. So if you place a solid structure in a very dynamic environment, like a beach or a dune that's constantly moving. Or think about it from the standpoint, if you are in your bathtub and you drop a block in it and then push water against it, right? And so the water is going to hit the block. It's going to reflect off the block. And then around the sides of the block, the water is just going to wash around, and then these bigger waves are going to attack the sides of the block. That's kind of the end effect. That's what we call end effect, and that's what happens adjacent to seawalls where you don't have a seawall. So waves are attacking the coastline, and it hits an area of the seawall and wraps around and actually exacerbates the erosion where the seawall stops on either side.
So the seawall is fairly useless or almost deleterious to some degree in certain areas.
Yes, some people say seawalls protect beaches. They don't. Seawalls protect the property upslope of a beach. They're deleterious to the beach itself because of, if you think about it, you know, let's say you've got either a vertical structure, let's say a vertical bulkhead. A wave comes in and smacks that. Well, typically you'll see these huge spray go up. That same wave energy is also being transferred down onto the beach. So the beach that's there actually lowers over time because the sand doesn't like to be in a super active location. It likes to be in an area that's calmer. So it moves away from the wall. So it actually deepens. And in the process of that deepening, what happens is as the water gets deeper, the waves can be bigger. So the waves that are attacking this wall at higher levels, and also at the same time, because you don't have a protective beach at all, the waves can be bigger.
In like a feedback loop.
Yeah, it's a feedback loop. And then eventually you get so much scour that the footing of the wall is exposed and then the wall collapses. And, you know, that's what happened in the 1978 storms, which led to passage of our sand dune rules, which led to basically saying no new seawalls in the dune system. You can only do dune restoration, beach nourishment, things like that. And that was a big, big, big step. Now, the rest of our coastline, like all the coastal bluffs that make up 48% of the main coast, they're not currently protected by a regulation like that. Yeah, so you can build seawalls. So about 50% of the main coastline is that traditional rocky coast that you think of when you look at a postcard and see like the famous Portland headlight that George Washington commissioned. That's the traditional main coastline, but about 48% is what we call erodible bluff. So that is 3 feet or more of sediment on top of where the high water line is that can erode and does erode relatively rapidly. These are features that formed from past geologic processes, like when ice sheets actually retreated, glaciers actually retreated off the main coastline, a lot of sediment was deposited. And so these bluffs that we see, and they can be anywhere from, you know, from 4 to 5 to 30 feet in height. They're made up of erodible materials. A lot of time it's clay interspersed with sand and things like that. And these bluffs are really, really important geologically because they are linked to the adjacent intertidal habitats, which are, you know, fringe coastal wetlands, marshes, mud flats, clam flats, sand flats, beaches, dunes, and all these adjacent habitats depend on the sediment and erosion of the sediment from that bluff to feed the adjacent habitat. If you didn't have that bluff there, the sediment that the adjacent habitat needs is not being provided. Yeah, some of it's being moved along the shoreline and along shore transport, but a lot of it is local sediment deposition that occurs when one of these big coastal bluffs, for instance, a lot of sand sloughs off of it, or there's, you know, just sloughing occurring over time, or just a big landslide that occurs. It's providing a lot of sediment to the intertidal habitat. And that's a location where living shorelines and nature-based solutions, at least in Maine, are very new. And there's something that we're trying to further through our understanding of the science of how these things work. But also from a regulatory standpoint, we're trying to implement rules that make it easier to build these kind of things. In our traditional approaches, it's actually harder to build a living shoreline than it is to build a seawall in a bluff environment.
Can you define the term living shoreline? What does that mean?
Sure. There's a loose definition which basically says, I mean, if you think about just walking along the coastline, whether you're walking along, you know, a section of beach, a section of estuary, and you see all these marshes and things like that. What did nature put there? You know, what grew there naturally? It's kind of an approach of thinking about what did nature put there and how can we mimic what nature has put there before. So a living shoreline is basically an approach to kind of attempt to stabilize a stretch of shoreline using natural approaches. And that can range from planting vegetation only on one spectrum to planting vegetation and interspersing some kind of hard infrastructure with it, whether it's, let's say, fallen trees, logs, rock, stone, to the other spectrum is what we call gray infrastructure, which is your seawalls, your bulkheads, and things like that.
But like a seawall would not be part of a living shoreline then, is that right?
Not necessarily. So there is this kind of gray area in between there, which we call green-gray approaches. Mm-hmm. So the greenest approach is, you know, just planting vegetation. The grayest approach per se is like a vertical bulkhead. You can have these kind of approaches where, let's say, it's a very high energetic environment, so you have to break up waves somehow. So that could be done by putting up what we call a sill of some kind, which could be, let's say, a mound of big boulders. And then landward of that, you restore marsh, or you take a bluff that's really steep and eroding and then kind of regrade it and then plant that whole thing with vegetation, native vegetation. So that kind of is a green-gray approach. So now there's this movement to green and then green-gray. What can we do to make the shoreline more natural?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Peter Slavinsky. He's a marine geologist at the Maine Geological Survey. So, Peter, maybe you can explain some of the techniques you and your colleagues use to create these living shorelines.
So that actually depends on the shoreline type. In areas where we've got sand dunes and beaches, there are these new techniques that are being used that integrate the use of kind of cores in when we're doing, say, a dune restoration project. Instead of just replacing the whole thing with sand and planting it with dune grass, there are cores that are being used. So those cores are some kind of fabric. So you think of like coconut fiber fabric that sometimes might have cobble in it if there's naturally occurring cobble. So what it does is it creates a stronger core that then you build a dune ridge over. And then there's also some techniques that are looking at using these cores, but not necessarily with cobble in them, but other materials that then you pre-plant and then build up, say, several layers of, and then build up a dune over it. I think the most interesting stuff is happening along our coastal bluff shoreline. So the traditional way of responding to an eroding coastal bluff is you basically riprap the entire slope, which is placing large rock that gets progressively smaller up the entire slope. And then saying, you know what, it's stable. We're not going to have any problems anymore. Well, what we found is a lot of those projects fail over time as well. So there's been a shift over to green-gray or even green approaches in terms of dealing with our coastal bluffs. And we've had a couple projects go in recently that are testing these techniques on large stretches of shoreline. So like think of 2,000 feet of shoreline. So instead of, you know, putting down solely rock, what these projects are doing is looking at what was the habitats that were there over time and what has been lost over time, say due to sea level rise and coastal erosion. So instead of just coming in and riprapping a slope, what these projects are doing is they're saying, okay, what's happening in the intertidal zone adjacent to that shoreline? Can we restore a marsh there? Okay, and if we're going to restore a marsh, how are we going to do it? Do we have to deal with ice? And of course, we're talking about Maine, so we have to deal with ice in a lot of these places. So let's put a nearshore sill out here. So that's basically some kind of hard structure. It can be boulders, it can be logs, something like that, that gets kind of anchored out into the intertidal zone. So say you've got mudflat, you've got this rock structure. Behind that, then you've got an area where you can restore marsh. So let's say historically there was a tidal marsh there. That can now be planted and restored because it has something to break up the wave energy in front of it. So then you've got a section of marsh. And then maybe from there you go to the next tier. Say you have a log system that's in place. Those logs are from the bluff that was failing. So all those trees potentially were leaning like this. All those trees had to be cut down. Typically, they're just removed from the site. Well, why not beneficially reuse them? So when you create a second tier with those logs, let's say you lash those logs into the mud flat or into the toe of the bluff, and then above that you regrade the bluff and then plant it with vegetation instead of running rock all the way up it. So we're seeing more and more projects that are either going solely to the greener approaches or going down this path of trying to hit that middle ground of green-gray approaches where you're mixing some kind of hard stabilization structure with a lot of these more vegetative approaches or regrading approaches that are beneficially reusing vegetation, beneficially reusing trees, to make it a lot more natural. And that's why we're calling it nature-based solutions. The other thing we've been playing around with, Alex, is the use of Christmas trees. So we have a couple areas where we've had a lot of erosion in our coastal sand dune systems, and learning from what other states have done, we developed a program this past year where we, instead of, you know, people taking their Christmas trees and just throwing them out on their curb and having public works pick them up, we had them drop off Christmas trees at the state park. And we were only hoping to get around 500 Christmas trees, and we got about 1,200 Christmas trees dropped off. But the idea was to then restore the dunes by putting the Christmas trees out on the eroded beach. So this beach that we were trying to restore had all these really well-developed sand dunes, and they were all flattened during the storm events that I talked about over the last year. So what we decided to do was put out Christmas trees in these rows on the beach so that as the wind blows, and as waves kind of wash up and wash up against the trees, sand's deposited. And we've been able to rebuild about 130 feet of dune at the state park using that technique.
Peter Slavinsky, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome, Alex. It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jerry Douglas, Keb Moe, and the Rolling Stones. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.